Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cries the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, pray for guidance. We'll be right back.
Freaky Darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets at the Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you are on the right night. But please check out our other At the Midnight shows. Fridays are split between Break On Through and Echoes in the Dark with Pam, and Sit In with Aphasia and Babble on Saturday as they teach you the fine art of becoming part saint, part sinner. These shows are designed to color outside the lines with ritual emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought through pen and voice. So pull up a chair, relax, and open your minds. I'm Rex, my co-host Pam Ray, and I can't wait to get into and read your words. Evening, Pam.
Good evening, Rex. How goes it?
All righty.
Awesome. What's thoughts? Oh, you know, life is good. Keeping busy, enjoying it, enjoying the poetry. I got to say, great lineup of poetry tonight. Looking forward to hanging out with you and maybe some other cool poets and, you know, getting into this. So inquiring minds want to know, and by inquiring minds, I mainly mean me, but what made you think to put Bukowski and Led Zeppelin together?
Oh, just some lines I remember from Zeppelin songs going back over the last 50 years. I mean, there was some great thoughts in there, like 'twas in the darkest depths of Mordor from Led Zeppelin, eyes that shine burning red, a big-legged woman ain't got no soul, I'm waiting for the angels of Avalon, a painted lady in the city of lies, down on this killing floor, you didn't have to leave me with beer in my face, heard a cry for mercy in the city of the damned, the clock on the wall's moving slower. There's a thread that has no end. I think I'm going to put you down for a while. And from in my old blue dungarees. So it would be a nice touch to, I did it with Morrison. So, you know, why not Zeppelin?
That is a nice touch. Yeah, I like it. And it did work out really well together because between the bit of, you know, darkness and the edginess, you really, especially the way you combine them, it worked out really well.
I picked out lines and matched them up to what I had. I mean, Let me see, eyes that died burning red, waiting for death like a cat that will jump on the bed. That was a nice touch there. Or she'd come back with that special stink again. A big leg woman got no soul. So I made him fit just based on the thoughts that we had going on. Cass had a mind and spirit. She, a painted lady in the city of lies. I was born to hustle roses down on this killing floor. Golden piss of dull temptation. You didn't have to leave me with beer on my face. So I was looking for particular lines that fit the motif.
But that could work well. Yep, you definitely tell that you put a lot of thought and a lot of work into it, and it was worth the effort because, you know, it, like I said, it's offered up great food for thought we've got a great lineup of poetry. So very cool thinking there. I look forward to... because I'm sure you'll be, you know, having another one of these shows, you know.
You can only dip in a Bukowski so much before it gets a little old. Then you got to spread it out a bit so you can just pick some lines here and play off of somebody else's lines and see what people come up with. It adds a little bit, something new to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, I like that idea. Very cool. Well, I look forward to what you come up with in the future. And just to let you know, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to bring Ed on. So welcome to the show, Ed. Glad you could be here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Welcome. Thank you, Rex and Pam. I had to set my alarm to get me up to read this, so I'm here.
I get that. I constantly I have my alarm set about two or three times a day for various shows or, you know, making dinner, whatever, you know. If I don't set my alarm,
oh, I believe
that's, it. That's it. Yep.
I believe it. Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Oh, no. Thank you for dropping into the show, too, as well as the concept. So we're pleased to have you.
Great. Great.
All right. Well, Ed, I know you have to read and run, unfortunately, but I understand that because it does get late. And I've gone ahead and I put your poem up.
Okay. One thing, I should have used a song that they have, but I was just writing a poem and I just picked up one of the songs just out of thin air. Okay, this is called "There's a Burning Sensation in My Ass." Like a brook trot hooked in the lips and trying to fight for freedom. Which one of you goes to all the parties and sticks to the worm? Which one of you pretends to be a friend, then chastised my rights under the silver sliver of your tongue? Paul, I apologize for reading. Wisdom is to admire, others before you boast like a raven and make your better half puke. Wisdom is to feed the ill-fortunate with an open mind and closed lips. Wisdom is to know your dog can't distinguish you from Hitler or Kennedy as long as you feed him. Which one of you looks into the mirror and learns what's inside instead of a shell that's just laying in the sun? Life is not just our Western culture that only exists. So why treat the world like a piece of shit? Sitting at the table while I'm writing this, I see my dog laying on his back with no nuts. Then I ponder, maybe we should castrate all the rapists, pedophiles, and dangerous criminals as a standard work of art. The truth is, we learn about death when we are dying. End poem.
Oh, great read. Ed, thank you very much. And you took prompt 10, which was, there's a thread that has no end. It's like a cobra. It's a hungry eagle circling the room. Nice. All right, Pam.
Thank you.
Why don't you kick us off?
All right. Well, this is great, Ed. And the way you read it with the conviction and the passion that you had in your voice, really just a brilliant and fierce read. Hard-hitting and edgy lines. That beginning line, like a brook trout hooked in the lips and trying to fight for freedom. You know, which one of you goes to all the parties and sticks to people like a tapeworm? That kind of made me think of the whole idea of the concept of catfishing, but it also made me think of the idea of people who are so desperate for attention. And, you know, fake beneath the, you know, they have that fake exterior. They just put on a show, you know, hard-hitting lines all the way through. I really like also wisdom is to know your dog can't distinguish you from Hitler or Kennedy as long as you feed him, you know, and that is so true. And I like how that's a representation of how oftentimes people are. If they see someone being, you know, so-called nice on the surface to them, you know, if they're like, hey, that person is taking care of me, that person is taking care of my needs, they're not necessarily always going to care about what's happening to how they treat other people. So I think while that can be literal, it can also be taken as a metaphor. Also, hell yes to the sitting at the table while I am writing this. I see my dog laying on his back with no nuts. Then I ponder, maybe we should castrate all the rapists, pedophiles, and dangerous criminals as a standard work of art. I would say definitely yes to the rapists and the pedophiles. You know, but that's just my thinking, of course, and it's a difficult subject to write about, but, you know, sometimes you just have to put it out there and you have to say, hey, this is the ugliness of the world. And we are the people sitting back being passive aggressive when we really ought to be standing up and using our voices. So excellent write and very well done.
Thanks, Pam.
When I started posting this, the title grabbed me. There's a burning sensation in my ass. And I didn't read it from there, so I'd already had an inkling about having that old rod run up the old dirt road too many times because it's barren, it's sandpaper notes. And I got adrift in that when you're reading that opening note like a brook trout hooked in the lips and trying to fight for freedom. That's the average person. And from then on down, you kind of walk in that note of, I'm going to go with not just the upper crust, so to speak. This is more along the lines of the political elite, the connected people in government, those who do all the rude awakenings that the rest of us have to bear. Because you hit on that, which one of you goes to all the parties and sticks to people like a tapeworm? Which one of you pretends to be a friend, then chastise my rights under the sliver of your tongue? Again, that note to sardonic humor, although we all know the answer because they're all doing it. And those three thoughts to wisdom I liked. Wisdom, do I admire others before you boast like a raven and make your better half puke? Wisdom is to feed the ill-fortunate with an open mind, closed lips. And I do like this one, really like this one. Wisdom is to know your dog can't distinguish you from Hitler or Kennedy as long as you feed him. And, yeah, that goes a long way to quite a bit of things that are going on. But I like that note to instead of a shell just laying out in the sun. And this one here, life is not just our Western culture that only exists. So why treat the rest of the world like a piece of shit? Now, the back end of this, that note with the dog also hits on the angle of how the common people are being neutered and spayed in the moment as well. So it's not just the angle of your dog who's got no nuts because you don't want him running the neighborhood, impregnating all the bitches and heat, so to speak, but you roll into that sort of a definite positive, I think, too. We should castrate all the rapists, pedophiles, and dangerous criminals as a standard work of art. Yeah, the pedophiles, rapists, you know what? I thought another angle for that was, hey, let's tell France, we're taking Devil's Island. We're going to put all them bastards on one place, and they can have each other all day long until they kill each other off. That's their sentence. And we should run it
that
up.
That would be great.
We should run it up as a bloody game show on Netflix or something. Place your bets, people.
Oh, I like that.
Kind of like Death Race 2000. but the funny thing is, truth is we learn about death when we are dying. That is true because we don't pay attention to death. Or most people pay attention to death in a way that they're afraid of it instead of actually living life. They worry about what life can do to them. The unfortunate part is we all know we're going to die anyway, so why worry about death in a moment? You got to live. And that the living angle kind of runs right back to that note of the trout hooked in the lips. Hey, it's time to fight back and say, no, mo, get those old hacks out, get some fresh blood, and get back to what was found to be in the beginning. The rights that we all bear within the Constitution and all those rights we were given under the name of God. He can only give those rights out, not any piece of paper or any lord or master who thinks they can take it all and deem us worthy of this, that, or the other thing. So I'm thinking this is for those class clowns in the political arena.
Thank you. What a great observation. I'd like to say one thing before I go. You know, Bukowski was a man time. And I think a lot of people should read his books. You know, some are pretty, you know, vulgar and stuff, but he puts it out there the way life is, and it's almost the same as today, or actually worse, you know, because of the time in everything. And he was a great writer.
It was. The vulgar angle was just actually his way of looking at life and making it real in the moment instead of trying to color in the within the edges and make it pretty.
Yes, you're right. Okay, I have to go. I got to get up at 5, and I appreciate you having me on. So thank you very much.
I didn't know you had to get up at 5, so thank you for coming on to read this for us, man.
Okay, great. Have a good day.
You too, man. Take it easy. Don't work too hard.
Thanks. Okay, thanks.
All right, Pam, where are we going next?
All right. Up next, we have Numbing Sensations with Simple Temptations by Jenny the Deep. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Numbing Sensations with Simple Temptations by Jenny the Deep. Can't feel my hands down to my toes, unable to even feel my erogenous zones. A line of white powder turned me into a lush, feigning, frying my brain into scrambled mush. While temptation numbing my eyes, white temptation numbing my eyes, while in my nose red liquid dries, only sniffed it maybe 6 times, but don't judge until you've lived this life. Alone at night, it's the safest bet. Make sure you have a safety net. Like a friend or a trusted lover is what I suggest, but maybe just not starting up is truly best. The last thing I want to do is to be an addict. Never will I die from the hands of this habit. Removing the pain while waiting for death is sometimes all we have left. End poem. And Jenny went with prompts 2 and 7. Oh, man. She hasn't got it. Where is that? There it is. She got it. 2 and 7 was Eyes That Shine Burning Red. Waiting for death like a cat that will jump on the bed. And 7, golden piss of dull temptation. You didn't have to leave me with beer on my face. So, all right, Pam.
All right. Well, first of all, great read there, Rex. This was a great take on her 2 chosen prompts. And I really thought this had some great rhyme and flow and powerful lines speaking on the struggles of addiction and the idea of, you know, that to be understanding of addiction, especially if you haven't walked in that person's shoes. And there were some great lines all the way through, but I especially like that second stanza with white temptation numbing my eyes while in my nose red liquid dried. Only sniffed it maybe 6 times, but don't judge until you've lived this life. You know, some of those drugs, all it takes is one time to become addicted. Then I also like with the ending where she says, removing the pain while waiting for death is sometimes all we have left. You know, when somebody's dealing with so much emotional and physical pain, it's easy to spiral into the world of addiction, and it's easy to pass judgment if you haven't been there yourself. So excellent write and very well done.
Nice. Yeah, that second stanza did walk nice into that number 7, the dull piss of temptation, and why don't you leave me with a beer on my face, so to speak, and for that second angle, alone at night is the safest bed, so make sure you have a safety net, like a friend or a trusted lover is what I suggest, but maybe just not starting up is true that And then the idea with the red eyes, and the cat was a little more sneakier because, well, snort and coke, you definitely get red eyes. But the cat angle had me with the thought of the coke itself, the nervous jitters, the hyperactivity that you get with it. So you kind of end up being nervous like a little cat, jumping on things, speeding around the room. Hell on wheels at 3 a.m., that's what cats are. And cocaine can get you that way too. Well, she did it right. Hitting on that note, can't feel my hands down on my toes, unable to even feel my erogenous zone. Well, that sounds like some pure pink Peruvian flake. A line of white powder turned me into a lush, feigning, frying my brain into scrambled mush. Yep, and also burn out your nasal passages too. So there is a note to watch. It's been around a long time. It's been used in many things, including Coca-Cola at one point in time. And it was a marvel of the earlier, late 19th and early 20th century because, hey, yeah, get me a pickup with a little bit of cocaine. And everybody's using it. It was quite well thought of back in the day and well used, as a matter of fact. And when the 80s rolled in again, you had that note, Miami Vice was part of the show in the 80s. That was the big scene, getting into Miami and out to the States. So nicely done, Johnny. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. All right. Let's see what we have next. We have Crimson's Rose by Betty Page. Come, love, and find me in the darkest depths of love. I'm your crimson rose, bleeding out for you. I turn pretty shades of blue. I'm colder than ice. And we're both twisted, my wicked, masochistic, undead sacrifice. I'm numb to embrace, sadistic look still on face, with my painted smile. His murder victim, wearing my torn apart dress, I now must confess. I've ripped my heart out, gave to you my blood red heart. Keep it with yours now, for you're my heartbeat. Ride with me forever. Escape with me, love. Secret locations where we'll be so indiscreet, entwining as one. Sweet, beautiful ghost, take me in your warm embrace. Revive me from death. I'm your pretty rose, porcelain doll on your shelf. Take me down a while. Free me from myself. Escape with me to the sea. I'm tumbling in waves, lost in emotions, spilling from my cherry kiss, juicy, sweet pink lips. I'm tangled in love, twisted by circumstances, squeezed till bloody pulp, cascading to floor, dark crimson rose of Mordor, vivid in darkness, maraschino girl. In such a cruel, lonesome world, past midnight walking, blowing rings of smoke, gazing at love's aftermath, flying above myself. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And Betty went with, 'twas in the darkest depths of Mordor upon the billion-blooded sea. Well, some of this kind of walks on that angle. Damn, this is a longer piece for Betty. Some of this kind of walks on that note of she being the, not just the crimson rose, maybe the black rose, the rose of death, that because she hits on an undead sacrifice, sadistic looks still on face with my painted smile, his murder victim wearing my torn apart dress, I now must confess, kind of hits me with the idea of a little bit of The Silence of the Lambs. And what else we got here? Sweet Beautiful Ghost, Take Me in Your Warm Embrace, Revive Me from Death, On Your Pretty Rose, Pour Some Dollar on Your Shelf, Take Me Down for a While. That note of playing with the bodies afterwards. Lost in Emotions, Spilling from My Cherry Kiss, Juicy Sweet Pink Lips. And then the back end kind of walks a little bit of the chance on that Dark Crimson Rose of Mordor, Vivid in Darkness, Maraschino Girl, something sweet and overly colored in the moment, in such a cruel, lonesome world, Past Midnight Walking, kind of on the back end hits on the note of a night walker, street walker, one of the forgotten ones in those parts of town that a lot of people go when they want to find something that they really want to find, whether it's drugs, women, or whatever indulgences they get into. So, nicely done, Betty. All right, what about you?
Absolutely.
Your new baby.
Great thoughts shared there, Rex. Yeah, I really liked the dark, visceral imagery and metaphors throughout this. And it's interesting to me how she portrays a character, a female character, it appears, that plays both the victim and the danger. You know, his murder victim wearing my torn apart dress, I now must confess. And then when she says, where was this? There was some other parts that really made me think that there was, and we're both twisted. My wicked, masochistic, undead sacrifice. So you see, it's almost like, as you were saying, you brought up the idea of it being somebody who's a street walker, somebody, you know, walking the streets and selling themselves. And I see that this is somebody who plays different parts according to what's needed in the moment. In order to get her the drugs or the money that she requires, and I did like the imagery in this with a sweet beautiful ghost, take me in your warm embrace, revive me from death, and I thought, you know, that really works well because it's almost as if the idea of the one offering of a true life, true warmth and true happiness comes from something or someone that is dead, something that can never be, you know, and while there's all this emptiness being fulfilled by all this darkness and, you know, soul stealing, there's that hope that can never come to fruition. The end line, speaking on that idea of where the end line to flying above myself, I thought was a great line speaking on addiction, not only addiction to drugs, but just the need to escape from the cruel reality of life. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
All right, what are we into next?
All right. Up next, we have Change of Mind by Grant G. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Change of Mind by Grant G. Rosebush she planted, all withered and dry. Did I forget to water her all through July? A year since she left me, childlike thinking I'd die. Tears on my pillow, yes, I did cry. No kissing or touching, began seeming unkind. A child with no sweetness ain't gonna be kind. Selfish, self-seeking, a male without grind. She took what I needed to comfort my mind. Running water into a basin, I'll resurrect life. Rose bushes are hardy, they survive winter strife. Trees lie barren without rain and shine. Birds sing in the garden, they always seem fine. Walking toward me, I think she might smile. She must have felt abandoned, it's been quite a while. Her thoughts protrude softly, wild in her style. Forgive me, dear lady, I've been acting vile. Like magic, it's clearing, there ain't no need to hide. Pouring water on dryness, all lost it subside. Rosebuds and petals, I'm happy inside. And poem. And Grant didn't actually put down which prompt he chose. So what do you think while I go take a quick peek?
All right. Well, I liked this. Great imagery and you know, wonderful dark write. I'll be honest, the vibe that I got from it was a story about a younger woman taking advantage of an older man, you know, and then him killing her because she got what she wanted. She was going to leave him, and he killed her and buried her beneath the rose bushes that she had planted, or perhaps he had. I don't. But anyways. I didn't want to directly say that in my written comment, though I'm saying it here on the show, because there wasn't anything really specific that pointed to that other than the general vibe of the poem. Still, wonderful imagery, great rhyme, and it did speak to me on a dark mind holding on to what will never be again. I do have to say that the whole idea of him killing her and burying her beneath the roses, well, first of all, you see what kind of person she is when Grant writes, no kissing or touching began seeming unkind. A child with no sweetness ain't going to be kind. Selfish, self-seeking, a male without any grind. She took what I needed to comfort my mind. So, you know, basically it was, you know, all about her. And then when it gets to the end and it says, you know, we're walking towards her. I think she might smile. She must have felt abandoned. It's been quite a while. Her thorns protrude sharply, wild in her style. Forgive me, dear lady. I've been acting vile. So it could be she's still awake or alive, but I get the impression of her being buried beneath the rose bushes. And he's basically talking to her as he's watering the roses. But whatever he meant by it, it is definitely a very well done dark rite that looks into the consequences of greed. So very well done. Did you?
Yeah. I was born to hustle roses down on this killing floor.
Aha.
So it kind of fits with the idea of what you're offering up. That note, a year since she left me, childlike thinking I'd die. Tears in my pillow. Yes, I did cry. So it's the kid. Whose mother has left, Bush, is that note of once a pleasant memory he had of her. And now it's kind of all withered and dry because he forgot to water. No kissing or touching began seeming unkind. A child with no sweetness ain't going to be kind. Selfish, self-seeking, a male without grind. She took what I needed to comfort my mind. Everything that a mother is supposed to offer up a child is gone once the mother is gone. If she walks out, things change a little. That note to no sweetness becomes selfish, introverted, self-seeking, so to speak. And then that note, running water into a basin, I'll resurrect life. Rose bushes are hardy, they survive winter strife. Trees lie barren without rain and shine. Birds sing in garden, they always seem fine. the idea is watering up that note to a life, or at least a point in life when things were a lot sweeter, a lot rosier. On the back end of this, like magic, it's clearing the rain, no need to hide. Pouring water on dryness, all lost, it subside. Rosebuds and petals, I'm happy inside. So bringing back something to him that reminds him of what was better at a better point in life. So he gets a little bit of joy in the moment of making sure that the rose comes to life and actually blooms. So there's something to enjoy that stuck with him from the early days of life with his mother, which is no longer good. And then it could have been the other way around. He buried it beneath the rose bushes, but then again, he'd have to be a lot older, and I'm not seeing that with this.
Okay, yeah, and you know what? I can see that. I didn't before, but I did not see it as a mother and child relationship, but when you commented and I started to read over it again, I thought, yeah, that could be a mother and child relationship, you know, in which case it is all... What was that?
Anger issues.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, perhaps like you were saying, the watering of the rose bushes is the idea of letting go of that anger. So, very cool.
What we got next?
All right, up next we have Greed by Ken Smith. That attractive rainbow of profit at all costs, the charm of the serpent's yellow eye, now the hole in the ozone, the earth's damaged black eye, having turned a blind eye to the ruin made of the planet, we have given it a virus. It cannot get rid of its immune system weakened beyond repair. Perhaps it was the earth that gave us COVID in revenge for our reckless riddling of it with disease and poem.
Nice. Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. And we took their number 10, which was number 10. There's a thread that has no end. It's like a cobra with 100 evils circling the room. On the back end of this, with the note to perhaps it was the earth that gave us COVID to revenge for our reckless riddling of it with disease. Hey, earth does that from time to time. Where the things like the Black Plague actually came from, and that note to... what was a real pandemic back in 1918 with the, they called it the Spanish flu. It didn't really come from Spain. It started there because of, there was a whole lot of death and destruction going on back then. And near the end of that time, 1917, going into 18, there weren't a whole lot of soldiers left on the front lines that were using the backups from those who do the transporting, running the ambulances, the supplies and such, and they were moved up to the front line, and they needed retreads for the back end. They brought in a whole lot of Chinese to do the backup support on the to the front lines. So that's a good probability of where the Spanish flu started. Come from China, much like this one did. Although it came from China twice. But I do like the idea in this. It does hit on the idea of sometimes the earth bites back. That's where we got all the volcanoes, and we've got those landslides into the ocean, which brings a tsunami. So the planet does offer up those notions of biting us in the ass when we least expect it. Why? Because it has its own life and the cycle it runs through. And we don't pay attention enough to those cycles. So we end up invariably getting spanked for it.
Yeah.
Nice. Yep. Done, Ken.
Well, I liked your observations there, and I did have to laugh. It's sad but true that, yes, oftentimes the planet does seem to be spanking us in the ass. I like that he wrote to prompt 10, but he also had a quote at the beginning of his poem by George Bernard Shaw. If there are men on the moon, they must be using the earth as their insane asylum. I think there's somebody else who had a similar quote. Who was it? He's somebody that we've done before. Keurig. Jack Keurig, I believe, might have had a similar quote. I'll have to double check on that. But anyways, brilliant imagery in this. And really thoughtful lines on the idea of a world lashing out at a people that are making it sick. And I really like where it says that attractive rainbow of profit at all costs, the charm of the serpent's yellow eye, now the hole in the ozone, the earth's damaged black eye having turned a blind eye. And you know, and of course, the one-word title, greed, speaks so much on that. The idea that we would destroy the world and destroy the future of other generations in order to get that brief moment of satisfaction for ourselves. So excellent write and very well done.
Okay. And where do we go?
Up next we have When You Go, Just Leave the Whiskey by Charles Grandante. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Well, Charles is a new one, so welcome, Charles, and thank you for the oh my God! Now I've forgotten. Thank you for the permanent fixture for when you enter our contest. That way you don't have to email us each time. So welcome to the club. When you go, just leave the whiskey by Charles Grandante, and he took the quote. I've come by, she says, to tell you. I think I'm going to put you down for a while. Hey, darling, I felt this coming on. I can't quit you, baby. Stay with me till dawn. I know why you're leaving. I said you messed up my happy home, maybe mistreat my only child. Don't you realize, sweet baby, I don't know which way to go. I can't quit you, baby. You're my one desire. But I can tell a bottle by its label you've made up your mind. So go. If you gotta, there's the door. Don't get hit from behind. Just leave the whiskey on the table. Take the money in my drawer. But before you go, sweet baby, I want your shadow to hear the screaming teardrop drowning in my beer. In loving you, darling, I gave my all. I even played King Lear. Look there, there's nothing left to fall. No life to live, no rhyme, no glove, not even a heartbeat left to give tomorrow's love. When you go. And poem. All right.
Well, great read there, Rex. And he wrote to prompt 11, and he said the first two lines of the poem were inspired by Led Zeppelin's song, I Can't Quit You, Baby. The third stanza is a direct lyric from same, and he threw in some King Lear, as he always hears Shakespeare in many Led Zeppelin lyrics. And not only Led Zeppelin, but if you actually, because I've done Shakespeare shows before, and when I'm looking for an intro song for them, I look up songs inspired by Shakespeare, and there's a, throughout the decades, you know, there's been a lot of them. And, you know, surprisingly in rock and roll, more than you would think, either songs that directly reference Shakespeare or are inspired by the storylines of like one of the storyline of one of his plays. But I really liked the lyrical quality to this, how it had a blues song feel to it. I also liked the bit of edgy, biting humor in the whole idea of, you know, don't let the door hit you on the ass on your way out. And you know what? Goodbye. Just don't take the whiskey with you. I really like, I can't quit you, baby. You're my one desire, but I can tell a bottle by its label. And I like that because, you know, it's a metaphor for, you know, you can see who somebody is. You can, you know, see they're not going to change. And so it's like, you know what, you're not going to change. I'm not going to change. We've both already got our labels, and that's what's going to be sticking to us. So go if you got to. There's a door. Don't get hit from behind. Just leave the whiskey on the table. Take the money in my drawer. Really just great lines all the way through. Wonderful lines. You know, I love the vibe of this. And also, as I said, I really like that reference to King Lear and the idea of the forsaken and the emptiness of life. And yes, I've read some of Charles' poetry for other shows and just in general in LNP, and I do enjoy and appreciate his poetry, and I'm glad that he wrote for the After Midnight show, and I hope he keeps being inspired to write for us more.
Nice, okay. Yeah, he does well. I can't quit you, baby, is a song title from Zeppelin, and he's got that note in that, maybe in this treat my only child. That's out of Zeppelin, one of the Zeppelin songs too. But I did like that large stanza. But I can tell a bottle by its label. You've made up your mind, so go if you gotta. Here's the door. Don't get hit from behind. Just leave the whiskey on the table. Take that money in my drawer. There is a bluesy note to this piece, and it has a noir feel to it as well. But this kind of, especially, I felt this coming on. I couldn't think with you, baby, save me to the door. There is that note of, well, not just the longing angle of it and the blues angle, but there's a note to, you know she's leaving, and you know she's going to take anything everywhere anyway. It's kind of like that final divorce, except he's not waiting for the lawyers to take it. He's going to let her take it up front and then go, except for the whiskey bottle. Just leave that where it is. And the back end, no life to live, no rhyme, no glove, not even a heartbeat left to give tomorrow's love when you go. Ooh, that is a nice hard note to the blues on the back end of this. The understanding that when she leaves out that front door or the back door, whichever one, she takes everything. And he gets left with nothing at the end of the day. So, nicely done, Charles. Thank you. All right.
Let's see what we have next. We have Slow That Clock by Peter Solway. Once a measured tick-tock tick, grandmama in rocking chair and candle wick, hearth of patient needlecraft, minor husband to rest with pipe and cough. Now all a high-speed rush, no stopping at lights, refreshments of stationary sights, cashier to pay then gone. Tomorrow always the fevered horizon, fuel of a harried Einstein, children of an old McDonald's farm asleep in the back. End poem.
Great read, Pam. And okay. Peter didn't illuminate on the back end either. Okay.
Peter never puts what he writes to.
I know, but sometimes you can usually find it. And I thought I had
that's
a note
good
with the tick-tock tick that alludes me to. Once a measured tick-tock tick, grandma in rocking chair and candle wick, hearth of patient needlecraft, minor husband to rest with pipe and cough. That's a note to older times, to the sort of grandma in the rocking chair and needlecraft, something that was taken up as part of home craft and what you put into the home itself. A lot of those needlecraft ideas were something like a home sweet home or some nuanced saying that you hung on the wall, or you needlecrafted pillows and such. The husband kind of hits me with the idea of, well, the miner, so you're probably looking at a coal miner, so it's something early 20th century in that note. But that middle one, now all the high-speed rush is walking into today. No stopping at lights, refreshments at stationary sites, cashier to pay, then gone. Kind of, no more note to humanity being a little more in tune and in touch with each other and themselves. And then that note, tomorrow, always the field horizon, fuel of Harry Einstein, children of an old McDonald's farm asleep in the back. I get the idea with this. It's a little bit of montage. What we used to have, what we now have, and the last one, what's coming about on the horizon, that fear of being back in almost a Stone Age atmosphere. No lights, no power, just fueled by our own hands at what we can do in the moment, because there won't be anything left.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Great observation. I think he might have written to prompt 9. I'm not Shakespeare, but sometimes simply the clock on the walls moving slowly.
That's the one I was looking for. I thought I missed that one. Yes.
Yep. But, yeah, I did like how, you know, to me this had amazing imagery and metaphors. I liked how there was a nice flow to this. Like, there were some spots where he actually had some rhyming, and even when it didn't rhyme, it really seemed like there was a lyricism to the poem. You know, I liked how it spoke to me on that longing for a time of slower and more easygoing days, when we weren't all rushing around, you know, when we weren't dependent on, you know, phones, computers, people all being as fast as possible because we had places to go and, you know, not necessarily people to see, but, you know, but yeah, this now all a high speed rush, no stopping at lights, refreshments of stationary sites, cashier to pay, then gone. And I like how that part there, but and then really the entire right speaks on the idea of how we've become too dependent on high speed technology, how we've become too dependent on, you know, the plastic cards that get us rung up quickly, you know. So amazing write by Peter, and very well done.
All right. Where do you want to go next?
Let me find the next one. Aha, here we go. Up next, we have Contemplation in Grief by Marriott Dark. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Contemplation in Grief by Marriott Dark. There is a silence between breaths, a palpitating emptiness, a faint buzzing like when you put an ear up against the digital alarm clock. There it is. A faint, smoky odor of the crematoria, and the pall of grief becomes overwhelming. It saturates my skin, my clothes, and lies like a coating on my tongue. And no matter what I do, I can't shake it off or piss it out or shit it out. It is part of me, like my cock and my balls. It becomes embedded in my DNA, threads of grief like fungus spores. It becomes part of me as I become part of it. And for the best part, I become another, a muscular apostasy and just one more dead man walking as he led onto the killing floor. End poem. And as he goes, I was born to hustle roses down on this.
Well, first of all, it's going to really bother me where exactly the line "there is a silence between breaths" came from, because I know it's from somewhere, but I'll have to figure that out later. It came from the poet Stephen Levine. That's it. Okay. All right. I knew it was from somewhere. But I mean, other than my short obsession with that, the whole poem in its entirety is just brilliant. A harsh look at the raw, edgy emotions of life. And how we want to let go of grief, but it's impossible sometimes to do so. And the idea that grief becomes so embedded within us basically becomes a part of our personality, you know. It saturates my skin, my clothes, and lies like a coating on my tongue, and no matter what I do, I can't shake it off or piss it out or shit it out. It is part of me, like my cock and my balls. It becomes embedded in my DNA. I feel like there's also that idea of, like with the coating on the tongue, like when you wake up and you got what's called the hairy tongue from like a night of drinking, and embedded in my DNA, it almost makes me think of the idea of how many like addictions or personality traits or abusive family dynamics can be passed along from one generation to the next. So amazing lines, powerful all the way through, and very well done.
Nice. I'm going to go a little different. A palpitating emptiness, a faint buzzing, like when you put an ear up against the digital alarm clock. There it is. A faint smoky odor of the crematoria, and the pall of grief becomes overwhelming. It saturates my skin, my clothes, and life like the coating on my tongue. And no matter what I do, I can't shake it off or piss it out or shit it out. It is part of me like my cock and balls. I'm going with that note. From that faint buzzing, that more or start with a palpitating emptiness, a faint buzzing. I'm going to go with a guy who's a mortician. The faint buzzing is the machine that's used to remove the blood and all refuse out of the body in order to embalm it. You get that faint noise with the buzzing from the machine itself as it's emptying out and disposing of the waste. The rest, it saturates my skin, clothes, the crematorium, also a part of the a note these days to those who prepare bodies, morticians. They don't have to go the full nine yards then if they're preparing a body for the crematorium, because they're turning that thing up to, I mean, it's 2,500 degrees, and even then it doesn't fully get rid of everything. There are still little tidbits of bones. That's where that saturate my skin, my clothes. You're spending all day doing this, the preparation of the bodies, the disposal of the bodies, and that sort of you can't piss it out, shit it out. It is a part of me like my cock and balls. It becomes embedded in my DNA. It's the natural process, because you are part of that natural process now. So the thought of places, morticians like this, it's handed down generation to generation. You get born into it from the family, and you grow up in that environment, and you walk into that environment knowing what you're doing, because you've been through it your whole life. Threads of grief like fungus spores, that normal note of seeing when you put the bodies out for viewing. Family, friends come in, that sort of thing. And for the best part, I become another hustler of plasticity and just one more dead man walking. The idea of, I might be alive in a moment, but I'm surrounded by death, another dead man in the moment. And as he's led onto the killing floor, again, he does the leading when it comes to when the families come to the viewing and all. So there is that note of the life, and they might contemplate grief itself, but they're surrounded by it every day to the point that they always seem to have dour faces or those rigid outlooks that people expect when they go visit before they end up going to the graveyard for final burial. For some, anyway. That's my point.
I like that. I like that. Very cool. All right. Up next, we have Finding Treasure by Darkened Auras. Merciless, mindless midnight murders flash before my eyes. A billion bloodshed upon this battlefield. I hear the echoes of their cries. Lightning strikes, a whirlpool forms, a void to my own demise. Deep down in the darkest depths, it lay sleeping for years. Now a perfect storm has summoned the beast. I've searched for my whole career. The blood and rain drove me insane and allowed me to see it clear. As it rose out from the ocean, towering over my tiny boat, 1,000 eyes just glaring through my sailor's yellow coat. I realized I had finally found the treasure, but I would never get to gloat. My life was now complete, not like I had much of one anyways. So I stood there at the bow and met this creature's mighty gaze. With open arms I fell to my knees and sung of his begotten praise. Tentacles raised from the water, picked my boat up, what a treat. Squeezed it like a sandwich, was I meant to be the meat? Opening its massive incisors, I knew I was about to be a meal for it to eat. End poem. I think it sounds like crazy. Somebody just met Cthulhu.
Christina took, 'twas in the darkest depths of Mordor upon the billion bloody sea. That was a nice fit. Plus, she did another one, Seeking Treasure, just the other day, which was the first one of the sequel to this is the sequel to that one, and that was a good tale too. But this one, like that one, it reminds her of that note near the edge of the world back in the days when everybody thought the world was flat, and if you sailed out to the farthest reaches, you would fall off the end. They used to have markings on the maps. Darby Monsters here. This one walks on that note again. You hit on the note of Cthulhu. Me, this is the Kraken, the tentacles. It says the incisors. I'm going with that note to the Kraken. You've got that huge beak, which comes crushing down. So I like this too. That's a double bite. So the other one was, what was the other one called? Seeking Treasure. And this one's Finding Treasure. And I guess if there's a third one, well, that's going to be deigned into the depths of Davy Jones and being part of the treasure. If there's a third part.
There should be a third one. There should always be a third one.
This sits on the idea of finally ending up in Davy Jones' locker. So maybe there will be. Christina, you got a third one in there for you?
There could be. Yeah, I like that idea. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I could definitely see the whole, like, release the Kraken But the thing that made me think of Cthulhu is just how there was like a sense of worshipfulness, you know, like when he said, my life was now complete, not like I had much of one anyway. So I stood there at the bow and met this creature's mighty gaze. With open arms, I fell to my knees and sung of his begotten praise. Like that's what made me think of Cthulhu. But no matter what the creature is supposed to be, it is quite the epic tale. And I do love a good seafaring tale. You know, they're just one of those forms of storytelling and poetry that I think will never get old, will always, appeal to the human need for adventure and mystery within a story. Of course, she's got great rhyme and flow. I also like how this works as a metaphor for the idea of seeking that which we think will fulfill our life and becoming so obsessed with the seeking that we end up never really truly having a life because we're so busy and looking for that treasure. Really great visceral imagery all the way through. I did like that ending. And I do think the way she left it off, it could end there, but I really think it's because she says, I was about to be a meal for it to eat. There's that potential for there to be more to the story. I also really liked the mention of the perfect storm, the idea of everything coming together as it is meant to be to create that perfect moment of chaos. And deep down in the darkest depths, it lay sleeping for years. Now a perfect storm has summoned the beast. I like that. Very cool and very well done.
Nice. All right.
All right. And let's see what we got next. We got Big Mama Don't Care by Guilty. And go ahead, Rex, and give that a read.
Let's see. Big Mama Don't Care by Guilty. Mama don't care about the price of gasoline per gallon. She don't care if one of those old men running for president makes it to the finish line. She thinks it's all a crock of shit filled with baked beans and sardines. She does love sardines. Salty as she is, she swears she hasn't had a good man since Bubba, and he has got old and lame. Mama's got a mean cough, but it's the damn cell towers. Again, she swears, the flu ain't got her dead. Mama still gives her wide girth to a man. He got to have some heft. Skinny boys, she'd break in half. End poem. which prompt did we get?
Three.
She'd come back with that special stink again. A big leg woman ain't got no soul. Yeah, those two lines were kind of a perfect funky fit.
Yeah, those two lines did work well together. Great read there, Rex. You know, I really liked this one because it has its brilliant imagery and metaphors and hard-hitting and edgy lines on the harsh reality of life. And the woman who refuses to change her thinking. I told him I think Big Mama needs to learn new positions so she doesn't keep breaking those skinny boys in half. And I really liked this all the way through. But I like how he takes everyday imagery, brings us into this woman's life. But it isn't, it's very Bukowski-esque in the way that, you know, there's nothing grand or fancy going on. It's this big woman, you know, eating her baked beans and sardines, using her crock pot, you know, going out and getting laid by, you know, the big boys because, you know, she breaks the skinny boys. And, you know, it's just the raw edginess of her everyday life and the thinking that she just doesn't change. She is who she is, and she's going to stay that way. And I really like, she thinks it's all a crock of shit filled with baked beans and sardines, and she does love sardines. Salty as she is, she swears she hasn't had a good man since Bubba, and he has gotten old and lame. Amazing lines and very well done.
I had me thinking of a song back in 2010, that's Bertha. Who's that? She one of the Buck sisters. But that second stanza, that she thinks it's all a crock of shit filled with baked beans and sardines. She does love sardines. Ooh, that's a hell of a nasty mix. So there's that special taint. She's coming home with that special thing again. Baked beans and fucking sardines. Yeah? That's why she's killing those young boys. She ain't breaking them in half. She's just killing them with the stench.
And oh, man, what a horrible week, Don.
The new flu can't get past the gaseous aromatics. So this is a large woman who says, the hell with the world and what's going on? Ain't nothing coming near to touch me except what I want to touch me. And that's some man with a bit of girth on him. So I guess the roly-polies, they're getting a little flowered in their sack.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Yoshi. That did offer up a few poignant ideas and reminders.
All right, well, up next we have Red Eye Golden Fellow by Blue Right 76. Born with gray ochres soft, touched by 100 sunny mornings, ray yellow stuck. Where the branches hid the golden god, black danced in glee, walked too close to the dark lord, green was taken away. Within the bars and bricks, gray blankets appeared through the windows as the golden bulb winked, midnight blue balls on white canvas with red wrinkles blinked, green beds under blue heavens, tanned skins and muddy paws, territory marks and scarring squirrels, the rainbow dreams far gone, moans and grunts with dead meat. Now he shed the colors all. End poem.
Pretty damn. And Suva took prop two. Eyes that shine burning red, waiting for death like a cat that will jump on the bed. Oh, okay. Born with gray ochre soft, touched by 100 sunny mornings, ray yellow stuck where the branches hit the golden moon. Walk too close to the dark lords. Now that's a line that kind of rings hard. Green taken away within the bars and bricks. So that idea of you walk too close to the dark lords, you end up behind bars, so to speak. Gray blankets through the windows with golden bulbing. Then the idea of seeing life from a different perspective because you decide to walk out outside the lines of what is promptly demanded of in quiet society, so to speak. And then again, that note to death on the back end, midnight blue balls on white canvas with red wrinkles blinked, kind of hits me the idea of maybe the death knell then again, Green Beds, the Tan Skins, Territory Marks, Scaring Squirrel, The Idea of the Burial Itself, Rainbow Dreams Far Gone, Moans and Grunts with Dead Meat. Now he shows it, the colors all. Moans and Grunts with Dead Meat gives me a thought of digging the grave itself. Moans and Grunts, the idea of actually putting the coffin in the ground. Now he shed the colors all. The idea of that final transition, no longer within that mortal coil, so to speak. That transition is free to roam in whatever it takes hold of in that moment. I like that. Nicely done, Blue. Thank you. All right. What about you?
Yeah, I like this one. I like the imagery in it. I took it very literally about being about just looking out your backyard and seeing your cat interact with all of nature. You know, the climbing of the tree, the scaring of the squirrels, the, you know, maybe catching a mouse or something, and finding some, you know, a dead carcass to explore. You know, but I like the idea that it also works on that metaphorical level. I really like where the branches hid the golden god, Black danced in glee, walked too close to the dark lords. You know, I think walk too close to the dark lords could be the idea of like the ravens or the crows, because those, I've had cats that got chased by ravens and crows because they don't take any shit. That's for sure. And then tan skins and muddy paws, territory marks and scaring squirrels. You know, it all just sounds to me a lot like a cat on an adventure out in the backyard, and all of nature getting up in arms. So excellent write and very well done.
Guess I'll have to reread that one a second time. Or a third time. All right.
All right, up next we have What's a Snake by Time Teller. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
A Snake by Time Teller. Sweet potato vine trails back and forth over the bed, can't see the end. Yet, can sense eyes that watch and follow my movement in this orchestral plane of growing. Hooded beast, all 20 foot, sometimes standing high, swaying, waiting to envenomate me with more toxin. I do bleed onto pages as well as earth. Ink becomes my shinzu, beating, fluctuating, and exploding upon the imperfection of living. Whilst my co swells into reluctant acceptance of wabi-sabi and eons of evolution that has thrusted its way before me. Stand and shout. How come? It's mandatory to accept and love imperfection while nature eventually will callously remove it as if a transitory punishment. To look up to a sky above and bow, a mighty eagle whose presence I have been aware of, soars. And now, snake, you're going to get it. It's like a loaded gun brought for pittance. Dying is cheaper than living. Bang, bang, and that's the fashion of overpopulation. Some lost teen residing within us all with a self-remedy of reboot. A detached video game with animated faces. Escape the ethos and reload the next life. Have you eaten sweet potatoes? I can't stand them. These imposters on the plate. It's bloody murder, this change. No, I mean it's bloody murder. Carbohydrate kingdom is my palace of safety, and the gods stand there in my defensive wake, maintaining the propriety of living. The hygienist said I was defensive. Am I? I am, I said, becoming self-aware to my clenched fists around the chair's arms and stiff legs. She was having to force apart lips to gain entry into the sorry kingdom of delusion and neglect. Or did she mean I never let anybody truly in. Hey, Eagle, might the snake get you? And maybe one day I'll be swayed to like sweet potatoes.
Yeah. Great
and
read there, Rex.
There's a thread that has no end. It's like a cobra. It's a hungry eagle stuck in the room. All right. What do you got?
Well, amazing imagery and metaphors and thought-provoking lines. I like how this is a rite of introspection, but it's also a rite that takes a look at society. Like it takes a look inside oneself and who we're willing to be and who we're willing not to be, you know, and the idea of, you know, what are your battles that you're going to choose? And also takes a look at our personal reactions to society's expectations and how, unfortunately, society has this idea that, you know, once we say this is the way it's going to be too oftentimes, then they expect everybody to line up and nod and smile. I did like where he says, stand and shout, how come it's mandatory to accept and love imperfection while nature eventually will callously remove it as if a transitory punishment. To look up to a sky above and bow, a mighty eagle whose presence I have not been aware of, been aware, off soars, and now, snake, you're going to get it. It's like a loaded gun bought for pittance. Dying is cheaper than living. Those are really amazing lines. And I did like the dark humor in this too, especially in the whole idea at the end of, well, maybe eventually I'll start liking sweet potatoes. But I kind of get the impression that he basically means, you know what, I doubt it. You know, the eagle's going to go after the snake. And that's all good and fine for the eagle, but the sweet potatoes just aren't what I want. So don't tell me what I'm supposed to like or not to like. So excellent write and very well done.
All right. I'm going to hit with the back end of this. It's like a loaded gun bought for pittance. Dying is cheaper than living. There's a whole lot of truth in that, especially when you can go up to Canada, or the Canadian government is offering up their citizens, hey, if you want to die, we'll help you self-delete. Why? Because it's cheaper than actually getting mental health. So why not? Hey, we'll just help you die instead. That'll take you off the rolls, and we don't have to worry about nothing. And then bang, bang, and that's the fashionable population. Some lost teen residing within all of us, with a self-remedy of reboot, a detached video game of animated faces, escape the ethos, and reload the next life. There is that note of people talking about having themselves downloaded into computer systems as the next thought to, hey, why should I worry about this body being here when I can live on in computer worlds? And this one, have you eaten sweet potatoes? I can't stand them. These imposters on the plate, it's bloody murder this change. No, I mean, it's bloody murder. Again, that reference to that thought of dying is cheaper than living, and then that note to plugging someone into the computer while removing them from their own body, in other words, downloading their minds. And that is a note to murder on both angles. But the imposters on the plate, the thought of sweet potatoes, it's a load of shit. You're being fed a lie. And it's supposed to be the sweet potato on the plate, but it's just a shit sandwich. and then that and next one down, guards stand in my defensive wake, maintain the propriety of living. The hygienist said I was defensive. Am I? I am, I said, becoming self-aware to my clenched fists around the chair's arms and the stiff legs. She was having to force apart lips to gain entry into the sorry kingdom of delusion and neglect. The idea of the delusions that are being offered to us as a quick set is on that place. And the neglect is the fact that we kept being, we're being force-fed that angle. So there is a certain amount of neglect in that. Hey, eagle, might the snake get you? And maybe one day I'll be swayed like sweet potatoes. So that the idea, the fight back, I'm not buying into your shit. And the idea of the snake and the eagle, I've seen, Pam, I saw a video of an eagle diving and picking up a shark and flying off of it.
Oh, wow.
All right. What we got next? Thank you, TT.
And up next we have Where the Bodies Fall by S. Sharp. And he was nice enough to supply us with a SoundCloud. So here we go.
Where the Bodies Fall. Let the mandolin play. Night joust the light of day. Hold the crucifix in dying hand. Carry thy burden to Avalon. Filter God through the eyes of man. Pillar of salt, let God be damned. Rock broken down into waves of sand, all crashing upon the shores of time. The fields plowed to city we take. Reap the sow, forever yield, guttered vermin. A modern world steps over the bodies. No sword nor arrow pierces the heart of the rabid dog. Neither night nor day.
Great read, Scott. Thank you for the SoundCloud. Very much appreciated. And he took prompt four. Held like a crucifix in a death hand, waiting for the angels of the Avalon. All right, Pam.
All right. Yeah, I like this. It's good to see a write by him. As always, just amazing imagery and metaphors. An excellent write that spoke to me on the idea that throughout history, some things change and some things stay the same. You know, we throughout history, there has been war and violence and greed and life and death. And, you know, throughout history, we've kind of had, I think, an indifference to it. But I think especially the more we see of that kind of stuff, the more indifferent we become to it. I really like the reference to the Lot's wife with the pillar of salt, through the eyes of man, pillar of salt, let God be damned, rock broken down into waves of sand, all crashing upon the shores of time. That idea of, you know, that eventually time takes everything and everyone. And the guttered vermin, a modern world steps over the bodies. I thought that kind of made me think of the idea of the guttered vermin, made me think of the Pied Piper, but it also made me think of the idea of living in a modern society with homeless people dying and nobody caring, nobody noticing, and the idea that, you know, they're used to. Like, it almost is like the first stanza is all about the battles that happen for a purpose, and the second stanza is the battles that happen for no reason whatsoever, other than the fact that people are merely trying to survive, which is a very sad thing. So, excellent write and very well done.
All right, thank you. Where the Bodies Fall. I mean, this goes back to 50 plus years now. Let the mandolin play. That's a note to Jimmy Page picking up the mandolin 1971 and Hedley Grange when they were doing doing the mixing and the music for a Zeppelin tour. The Battle of Evermore was the song which the part of the quote came from, and also the mandolin was featured in the Battle of Evermore. All the Crucifix and the Dying Hand, it speaks about water. And the Angels of Avalon was also from that song itself. Through the Eyes of Man, Pillar of Soul, Let God Be Damned. Rock broken down into wastes of sand, all crashing upon the shores of fire. It speaks of the battles, I think, of the 15th century between England and Scotland. The fields plowed, the city we take, reap the sow, forever yield, gutted vermin, the modern world. So he's gone from the older angle into the more modern angle, and still the same. The fields are plowed to the city we take. The idea of the big cities always take more than their fair share because there's more people, and yet they don't really understand the angle of where the food comes from because we just go to the store, so to speak. The gutted vermin, it's on the idea there's always rats within these cities because nobody takes care to clean up and ask themselves, so to speak. The bodies, that also hits to the inner, especially the inner city, inner angle of the cities, where the poorest are often found, where drugs are plentiful, amongst other things. No sword or arrow pierced the heart of the rabid dog, neither night or day. The idea of the rabid dog, those brutal angles of living, the rabid dog. They have no hold to either night or day. They just run their role in what they're supposed to do, and it's usually terror and mayhem. So I like this. This is different. You dipped into both angles of this, playing off both. I like that. Thank you, Scott. All right, hey, what are you doing now?
All right, up next we have Where Streetlights Burn Out by Julie Buck. Bummer when you wait on eggplant for so long, and then it's not as tasty as you had imagined, but this so was. Another night of cat noises, me doing this and that, writing and recalling my supper of eggplant parmesan. That was one perfect purple veggie. I do live by myself in a trashy area, a zip code known for crime, you know, but I just lay low and figure no one wants to steal from poverty. My fingers stopped typing when I heard the help me scream, and then everything was silent and still. Was that one kill for them? Am I still who I am in this city, be damned? Or am I eating pistachio ice cream? Tomorrow, my typewriter goes in for grief counseling and poem.
Great read. Julie took another one we hadn't seen yet, prompt 8. My typewriter was tombstone still, heard a cry for mercy in the city of the damned. When street lights burn out, that's a nice note to the piece itself, as well as already walking in an atmosphere where the street lights burn out. Is that note to darkness, where things seem to happen always? And she hits on that that idea of an eggplant. It's about as tasty as you had imagined, but this so was. Capitalize there. Kind of the story that she's hitting on next. Another night of cat noises, me doing this and that, writing and recalling my supper and that plant parmesan. That was one perfect purple veggie. So she's gone from the angle that it wasn't as tasty as one might think into being a perfect purple veggie. Kind of an offering up of herself, so to speak, in that. Trash, living in a trash area of the city, zip code known for crime, you know. But I just lay low and figure no one wants to steal from poverty. There's a certain amount of truth in that. But even those who are out on the street who have even less than you will steal from you because they're even worse off than you are. And I heard the help me scream, and then everything was silent and still. It hits on that idea of even in a place like this, people are afraid to do something because they don't want to end up right next to the scream that they just heard. And was that one kill for them? And offering up right there. Hey, if you hear that one scream for help and it stops, yeah, it's probably already been done. Am I still who I am in this city, be damned, or am I eating pistachio ice cream? That is a twisted turning note. Did I just imagine that? I'm just sitting here watching TV, eating pistachio nut ice cream as that note to, do I really want to answer the door and take questions from the police? And then if it's like, no, I didn't hear nothing. Bye. Tomorrow my typewriter goes in for grief counseling. So the reference is doubled there. The note you know something happened, you didn't do anything about it, and the grief counseling is the fact that you feel bad, but not that bad that you want to be part of the crime scene itself.
Yeah, I really like this and the bit of a dark, twisted humor, especially at the end. Tomorrow my typewriter goes in for grief counseling. And I like how she takes us in this right from that everyday imagery, you know, the disappointment in the eggplant, you know, to the bringing us into the reality of it all, of living in a difficult neighborhood filled with a lot of crime. And I really like that line. But I just lay low and figure no one wants to steal from poverty. It's like that whole thought of, you know what, go ahead, come in, break into my house. There's nothing to steal in here anyways. I did think the pistachio ice cream did sound really quite good, but I like the questions asked. Was that one kill for them? Am I who I am in this city, be damned, or am I eating pistachio ice cream? You know, those questions that ask, what is the reality of my life? I feel like in part this is the idea of an author who has blended their fictional life so much with their real life that they're really no longer sure where one starts and the other ends. So excellent write and very well done.
Well, there was a note that had me thinking of something that was around 2 a.m. in Whitechapel in late of 1888. There was a cry of murder in the night, but nobody did anything about it until the next morning when they found Mary Kelly shredded to pieces in her little one-room hovel.
Oh, wow. Just think how history might have been slightly changed. Interesting.
No, that's what the point was. When you're in that type of environment, you hear that, people stay away from it because they don't want to be part of it.
Well, I still think it's interesting how the little moments can be a change for history, but yes, that is generally how people are, is we tend to, go into an almost self-protective mode.
Yep.
All right, up next we have "But It Is a Pluperfect Fact" by Jim Bellamy. And go ahead, please, Rex, and give that a read.
Okay. "But It Is a Pluperfect Fact" by Jim Bellamy. "But It Is a Pluperfect Fact" that my bedbound mother-wife is a peach of a dead female lord. Perhaps it is fair to say that she is alike to the daughter of Pan or the director of Gilly Girls and the dizzy son of man, the sunny sea gal me and Mastiff have known since the dawn of moon-strode babies. Oh, hereby, an earth of sunshifters comes igniting buds with wet lung bites, and it would have been surely very wrong to hope for a white and vermeil rubbished wedding. Oh, this new bride of mine is forever part mad as sex and Pluto's crapulent birthdays. And when I kiss love's tongues, then I will rend the leech cans from beery bluebirds and the nice spies on the moon. My butcher baker vendor dresses for a naked light dinner, and 1 million customers in just one evil restaurant will spin Fed Zimmers as he extemporized the maker, and the maker has a name, and that name is Genghis Khan. Oh, Genghis Khan has the worn face that does down meager debts, and Genghis is known to neon boards on the whipped, raped, and combed. And it is to Genghis that I take a swift walk with naked bully boys who rock with cocks of a distant penis. And boom. And well, actually, and Jim took prompt six, which was number six. I was born to hustle roses down on this killing floor. All right.
Well, intriguing lines as always, thought-provoking and powerful imagery and metaphors. I like how this speaks on the craziness of the world and the craziness of sexuality throughout history, the ugliness and evil that takes over the world, and the idea of, you know, just wanting to escape from it all. You know, and I noticed that he brings up Pluto, who was actually the god of war, and then Genghis Khan, who, of course, was, you know, very much well known for his war campaigns and as a leader of battles. And so it just really looks at throughout history, both in reality and mythology, how, you know, these battles fought, these losses and these victories have long been a part of history. And I really like, and it would have been surely very wrong to hope for a white and vermeil rubbished wedding. Oh, this new bride of mine is forever part mad as sex and Pluto's crapulent birthdays. And when I kiss love's tongue, then I will render leech cans from berry blue bursts and the nice spies on the moon. Wonderful lines on the idea that which appears on the surface to be innocent is not, and the reality of it all. So excellent write and very well done.
Nice. I did the bite with Genghis. That kind of has me thinking a couple of things. You know that across the world, a lot of people, more than most people would think, have Genghis Khan's genes within themselves. He left quite a mark on the world. And despite, as the warring fates does down nigger deaths, old Genghis is known to be on boards of the whips, raped, and cold. And it's to Genghis that I take a swift walk with knighted bully boys who rock with cocks of distant penis. That kind of hit on the idea that he spread his wealth in more ways than one. And yes, he did do a lot of damage. You know, he used to take diseased cows and catapult them into the castle courtyards to spread disease. The guy was,
oh, wow.
Yeah, literally diseased cows. Yes. Yeah. Not a very nice guy, but he was the scourge of the the steps, and then a good portion of Europe too. I think at one point, his troop got hit with the plague, as well as helping to spread the bloody plague. So, yeah, Genghis did rout quite a bit. He did spread his seed all over the earth. So, talk about someone who has a hand in today's world with his brethren.
Well, yeah, because it's something like, I don't remember the exact number, something like 1 in 5 people in Mongolia is relation, you know, to Genghis Khan.
Well, I think more than that, as far as from across the world, because he
well, I said I didn't know the exact number.
Yeah.
What was that, Rick?
Oh, I said it's probably a bit more than that, considering he was all over the place. Let's see. Oh, maybe not. 0.5% of the male population in the world, or roughly 16 million descendants living today. So he did.
Yep.
He did walk his. He did strum his goodies around the world.
Oh, he definitely did.
Here we go. 1 in 200 worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew it was.
Well, that's meant that he had his own harem, too. Talk about concubines.
Some of his marriages, though, like many marriages in that time period, were mainly for political gain, or you know what I mean? But there definitely was a whole lot of spreading around of all his glories and all that fun stuff.
He wasn't known for his political largesse. He just ran through everything, literally. When the hordes came out of the east, everybody fled because they knew what was coming next. All right, where are we going?
All right, up next we have In the End by Naomi Sarah. Beneath his bloodshot eyes hung bags with skin reddish and raw, as scruffed leather on swollen suitcases packed with air instead of trinkets brought back from all the places he had talked about, saying he wanted us to see them together, the only cities now visited being the ones where his favorite hockey team played. He'd sit there staring into the inside of an arena, from his old armchair to the gleam of the rink, the frozen ice laid out to be slashed into by fast, sharp blades, like the veiny purplish crevices that dug into his hollow cheeks as he sipped on a weak old Diet Coke that had lost all its fizz, saying he liked it that way, the stale, acidic blackness fermenting in the bottle he'd choke on, coughing until he keeled over, spitting out death between two cigarettes, the final ragged breath waiting to whistle through his cracked, blistered lips, like a horny mosquito waiting to suck the blood from some juicy, fat dick. And he wheezed and shivered, too proud to reach for the blanket I tell him to use the damn thing, him snarling and pushing it away, skeletal fists raised, swearing into the TV until his eyelids drooped and his bald head wobbled, dropping heavily into his heaving shoulders, the chill ticking of the clock counting down the precious minutes left in the game until the winning goal was scored without him, and I almost hated him for it. End poem.
Gregory Penn. And Naomi took eyes that shine burning red, waiting for death like a cat that will jump on the bed. This is visceral in its representation, right from the note with the idea of hockey as the backdrop, and the thought of watching those games once live, but now being on the back end and watching it from an armchair or a lounge chair, whatever. But she's really quite dug in with the description. Bloodshot eyes, hung bags, with skin reddish and raw, scruff leather, on swollen suitcases packed with air. Oof, that's quite a note to the puffiness under the eyes. Instead of trinkets brought back from all the places he had talked about, saying he wanted to see them together. The only cities now visited being the ones where his favorite hockey team played. Staring into the inside arena from his old armchair to the gleam of the rink. And then death is that, because here we go, the frozen ice laid out to be slashed into by fast sharp blades. The description got hit on the note of death, too, like the veiny purplish crevices that dug into the hollow cheeks. Oof. There's no holding back to the disgust, even disdain. And like she said, almost hate him for it, but not quite, but does show touches of disgust and disdain that anyway, wheezed and shivered, too proud to reach for the blanket, I telling him to use the damn thing, him snarling and pushing it away, gallons of fish raised, swearing into the TV, kind of reminds me of a very weary old man, a father figure, or just someone who's really abused their own body to the point that they are just a rag doll, just a bones and a little bit of sackcloth covering it, so to speak. And that note to the he's still watching the game, but he don't get to see a team win because he's already walked out the door, so to speak, literally, and into the next world, which is, hey, now I get to bury the old stuff. Ooh. Brutal load.
Yeah.
This was pretty brutal.
Definitely is very raw and edgy. And the emotion that she brings out with this, but she puts us into the mindset of this character who, you know, wants, I think, in a way, to feel sorry for this guy, this person, as you were saying, who's abused themselves and their body to the point of dying. But at the same time, there's this anger. There's this anger about, you know, what they've done to themselves, but also because of the unexpected twist that life took. You know, at the beginning of the relationship when everything was good and there was these promises made of the places they were going to go and the things that they were going to see. And then in swoops death and all ugliness, and then of course comes the anger felt, the anger of realizing those things you dreamed about, those things you had hoped for, were never going to come true. And then I do think that end lines are particularly powerful, but I also thought the visceral imagery of as he squeezed and shivered, too proud to reach for the blanket, I telling him to use the damn thing. You know, that interaction between the two characters where you can see the rage, the anger that they both have in that moment for what life has become for both of them. So amazing write and very well done. And great show tonight, Rex.
Yes.
We have five carryovers.
How many?
Five.
Oh, okay. That sounds about right. Yes. All right. Great show. Ed, thank you for stopping in to read and sit with us for a few minutes. And, well, quite the menu of sport for tonight. It worked out nicely.
Absolutely.
So far. We'll do the what we have left, though. We'll go into next Tuesday's show, and we'll send out note to that for next Tuesday. So if you didn't hear it tonight, it shall be on next Tuesday morning. And with that, we shall see you all next Tuesday, as we do after midnight once again. So good night to all, and have a lovely Tuesday.